Now on documentary and drama on News Talk. It's 2 years to the week since fighting broke out in Sudan, instigating what is now the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Reporter Sarah Madden visits northern Bir el-Ghazal to see the fallout for herself in Can You Hear Me? Dispatches from the World's Forgotten War. A warning that the following programme pays reference to violence, sexual violence and suicide and may not be suitable for all listeners.
In South Sudan, among the Monyong, or the country's Dinka tribe, there's a belief that these are the first and most favoured of God's sons. They say he wanted to create the tallest men before any other. He gave them cattle to feed off and the most beautiful women to marry. Indeed, the Dinka are the tallest people, at least in Africa, coming in on average at 6 feet. And their women, with razor-sharp cheekbones, now pose in fashion magazines like Vogue. So when the Dinka also say South Sudan is the Garden of Eden, having 4 major rivers and plenty of snakes, we could be forgiven for believing them. But then again, why would God put the Garden of Eden next to hell? Two years of relentless war and conflict have left Sudan in ruins. Its infrastructure, economy, and healthcare system is all but obliterated, and almost a third of its people have been displaced. Both sides, the rebel RSF and the military SAF, are accused of war crimes, and yet international powers have been virtually silent on the issue. The media has all but neglected its people, homeless and starving though they are, and the trickle of aid currently making its way to Sudan is about to drip its last drop. So 2 years almost to the day of this cataclysmic war's outbreak, I'm heading to the border to hear the voices of those fleeing the world's forgotten war. Touchdown in Awil, northern Bir el-Ghazal, South Sudan. The heat creeps towards 40 degrees, and everything as far as the eye can see is flat, dry, and red.
Hi there, how are you? Nice to meet you, I'm Sarah.
The scenes from the car window are indeed biblical. Men herd cattle, children play outside huts, women carry water on their heads. The dirt road we travel on is arrow straight, but it's littered with deep potholes. I'm glad of the white four-wheeler we travel in, with its no weapons aboard sign on the flank.
Can you give me your name and your title, so your position?
Okay, my name is Emilia Muchka, and I'm a program coordinator for the Safe and Dignified Transition Project, working with Concern. We have left our base in Nyamleo, which is in northern Bir el-Ghazal, and we are heading to Kiradem, which is the border point between Sudan and South Sudan. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we have a project that is operating there. We are offering health services, protection services, and nutrition services to specifically targeting the refugees and returnees, also the host community.
Two-thirds of those who cross the border into South Sudan are returnees. People originally from South Sudan who may have fled north during previous times of conflict here. Many have been made refugees now for the second, maybe even third time.
You know, refugees and returnees, they are facing a myriad of challenges. Migrating from the other country and seeking refuge in another country, obviously you come with a lot of challenges. You are displaced out of your home. You are lacking basic supplies, basic necessities like food, shelter. Even your health is at risk. So we are responding to the immediate health needs, you know, which are essential services for everyone to survive. Displacement indeed comes with psychological effects and sometimes also emotional trauma. Remember, they are running away from war. They are coming into unfamiliar territory. And obviously it's an unfamiliar environment. You are vulnerable, you are at the mercy of the people who are going to receive you. And it challenges you as a person to say, am I going to continue to be safe? Am I going to make it? So it really takes an emotional and a mental toll on you.
The Sudan war has created the worst displacement crisis in the world, spreading millions of refugees around East Africa. 1.1 million have crossed into South Sudan at border points just like this one in Kiridem. 28-year-old Amima is one of them.
I came from Khartoum. I could not stay there because the fighting was very serious. So I decided to come to South Sudan. My parents were killed during the war. My brother plus my children and also my sister. My brother and my sister were killed using, they slaughtered them. And also some of the family members were burned inside the house. And that's why I ran from Khartoum to South Sudan.
It took Amima 8 days to walk here with her remaining children from Khartoum, the country's devastated capital that's been dubbed Sudan's Aleppo.
There's no way out unless we leave our houses and our towns, so as you know, to go to the, you know, the secure place.
30-year-old Musa was a university student when the war hit Darfur. Here, the RSF have been credibly accused by the US of committing genocide.
You know, our village is destroyed totally. Destroyed totally, there's nothing. So the majority of the people there who are living there in our area, they are escaped. We have, you know, some cattle, and they have been taken. And we have, you know, same, you know, the shop also destroyed and the barn. One of my family member, you know, had been, you know, shoot there in front of us. The one who is younger than me.
So you had a brother that was
killed? Yeah, the brother, yeah. Shooting by the gun.
The journey south can also be treacherous, particularly for those traveling on foot.
And we spend many days on our way. So we meet, you know, many different people. They took our thing and they beat us and they use everything that they want. Yeah, they still all my family that remaining. Just the only one that, you know, I have find a way that to escape. And to find a way so as, you know, to feed them. I'm very afraid for my family. Yeah, day and night I'm thinking about my family. Really, I'm suffering.
The majority of refugees and returnees are women and children. They travel in groups for safety, and many make the journey pregnant.
My name is Atong. I have 24 years. I'm pregnant, 6 months. I have 2 children, and this is going to be the 3rd one. Because of war, she fears she can, her and her children can be harmed. We fear. We live in fear. So we can be killed anytime. We sold our property all so we can took a car to come to South Sudan. But the money is not enough. When I reached here, they took the rest of my property that is with me so they can fill that gap of the rest of the money I didn't pay.
There wasn't enough money for Atong's husband to join in the family's escape. And sitting here, cradling her baby, the young pregnant mother's isolation and her fear are palpable.
Can you tell her thank you very much and we wish her luck with her pregnancy?
Translating for Atong is the sole midwife at Malik Mir Health Center, Atong Jessup.
Yeah, we have a lot of cases. Sometimes we have in malaria season, the pregnant mothers, they come, a lot of them, with malaria. Some they have STI, which have UTI, have to treat them because it's common. Because the immunity become very low. And here, they don't have enough balanced diet. So when they get pregnant, they become weaker. And we have deliveries here every week. This week we have 4. Anytime a mother come, I can help her. Even they can in weekend, like Saturday and Sunday, sometime they came even at night, 24 hours. Yeah, there is a lady. She's coming to facility. She deliver outside there.
Atong points at a wattle gate on the roadside.
That is night. So they called me and I rent. I come and I help her. Then I bring her to the facility. She deliver outside. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she didn't reach the facility. That is like 2 a.m. on the road. We don't have a rest. We work 24 hours. And my home is very far. I used to go once a month to see my children. So all the time I'm here and all the time I'm busy.
And have you ever had cases where pregnant women have arrived with cholera, cases like that?
Yes. We have like three. In this outbreak of cholera, we have three pregnant women who have cholera, but we manage them.
Is that dangerous?
Yes, it is very dangerous for them, but they survive.
These women were lucky. The cholera outbreak among border crossers has become deadly, infecting 180 people in just a month and killing 15, including a child. Indeed, a structure reminiscent of a 2010s Ebola tent has been set up here, with white and red tape across the front, warning people away.
Assalamu alaikum.
Inside, it's hot and airless. Bavita sits on a cot next to her daughter, trying in vain to fan the flies away from the sleeping 10-year-old's face.
Yeah, she said that this morning the child is raised good, and then a few minutes, so she feel that she had a fever, and then she start vomiting and water diarrhea. She was vomiting three times, so I took her to the clinic here. So and then now she was on medication now. I'm worried that my child is still dehydrating, but I have a hope, maybe.
Bavita is clearly exhausted. Still just in her 30s, this is the second time war has forced her to up and leave her life and her home.
They work by foot from Sudan to come here. It takes about 10 days to reach here. On the way there is a big fight there, and some of the militia, so they have been abducting some children, and their properties have been detained. So they came with nothing. And the husband was left there. Even now she doesn't know what's going on. They don't have news about him now. They have a whole year without talking through a phone. Even so she is and her children alone here. Even now she said that we are here for nothing, because even she don't have a job to feeding her children. And she said that I have a lot of problems here because of condition.
The conditions here are indeed unhygienic. Without clean drinking water sources, residents use the Kir River, situated though it is near open latrines. And it's that unsafe water that's spreading cholera and other diseases among the migrants and the 10,000-strong host community here. Local officials fear in the upcoming rainy season, patient numbers will spiral.
Yeah, it will be a very big problem.
Santino Bol Agani is Concerned Project Officer for Health and Nutrition.
It is summer, okay? But during the wet season now, where now rainwater will wash everywhere, you know, and the case of cholera will increase. If it subsides completely by this dry season, that will be good. But if it will continue to reach up to the wet season, it will become very difficult.
Do you have predictions as to what the outbreak might look like in the wet season if it's not contained in the dry?
Yeah, it will be very difficult. It will be very difficult in the wet season. Almost everyone who is, you know, staying here at them, almost everyone. Because like if you can see at the moment, in the last 1 month last, we have seen about 180 during this dry season. But if when it is wet season, it will be almost every household will be affected by the cholera. So it is very worrisome.
You're listening to Can You Hear Me? Dispatches from the World's Forgotten War on Documentary and Drama on News Talk.
A couple of cold food Football Association became peaceful center, and we are very happy to the MSF and the ministry who mitigated cholera outbreak in Akobo County.
It's day two of my trip here in northern Barra Gazal, and we're coming up to the high point of the day's sun.
Thank you so much for your messages. Do keep them coming.
The sky is a cloudless blue, and along the roadside we travel, there's barely a soul. So I'm surprised when, almost out of nowhere, the car is swarmed by women who are dancing exuberantly despite the blistering heat.
That's a bit of radio for you now.
Absolutely. Thrilled with that. You wouldn't know it to see their smiling faces, happy to welcome foreign reporters into their midst. But this crowd of refugees and returnees are here at FAM Mobile Clinic for counselling, burdened by the trauma of gender-based violence, sexual assault and rape.
Sometime in a week, I usually have 150 clients, and also sometimes I have 15 or 20 GBB survivors per day.
Robert Akul Garang is a concerned social worker providing psychosocial support.
Actually face sexual violence because some military men or soldiers, they force them into having a sex. So this one is really make them so traumatized. They are really so shameful, and they feel to isolate themselves because they feel humiliation into the community. They feel humiliated. And sometimes when I have such a cases like rape, I do counseling and I refer them to our referral pathway mechanism.
I have heard reports of sex slavery in Sudan. Do any of the women coming here, have they been taken by the military for long periods of time before they escape? Have you seen that?
Yes, I have some women. Sometimes they came here, and when I'm doing counseling or psychosocial support, sometimes other survivors told me that they were being forced to be married by military men in Sudan, which is the soldiers, and some of them were usually escaped from those who were forced them into marriage or into sexual violence.
Everybody was been fighting, the gun shoots, even they make the knife to be slaughtered. They just make the fire bans to burn everybody. Also, those people, they will just get you in your house with your husband. Then they bring gun out. Then they come say that I need you to sleep with her. So if the man can talk, the man can be shoot. Even from 17 years down. Those ladies are not ready. I myself, it happens when those people come. I was inside with my husband, and then to rescue the life of my husband, I told him that you just branch out from the side of the room and then leave me with them to save your life. Until that is the way that I save the life of my husband and myself until I come out. And that one was paining me a lot until I ran out from that place.
That was Mary, nursing a young baby as she spoke. Ellen, a striking girl in a daffodil yellow dress, sits next to her. She's victim of a different kind of gender-based violence, forced marriage.
When I grew up, almost 18 years or 17 years, the man took me by force. Then I realized from the hours, this man was a married man, and he was fighting with his wife every time, until the first wife ran away. Then he brought me by force. A lot of shames. Maybe we'll be full of everything to think that I'm going to kill myself. Our relative took me back. I'm still now not safe because our relative says another man to be given to me. To be given out again, no. If I stay alone, I can be safe. Like now, look at my dress. Because of my hand, I used to go and work. I buy my everything that I want. But our parents learned now to give me to another man.
Yeah.
forced marriage, is that to do with the war, in the sense that are they trying to sell their daughters to get money to leave Sudan?
Yes, they want to build their, like to give their daughters to the people who are having powers, like business people and the other people that are having resources. So they feel if they give their daughters to those people, they will get something. And this is one of them that posed them to give their daughters into, pose their daughters into marriage.
Intimate partner violence is as common here as forced marriage. Significant, Robert believes, of a people whose whole lives have been marked by war.
Yeah, the common one is the beating. They were being beaten, they were being kicked. By the men in the community, they have been doing. They have been banned. Like some men have been shooting. Like they want to shoot a woman. Some other men want to use knife to just to kill a woman. So these are the some of the common thing in physical violence. Mm-hmm. In the community.
Actually, there are a lot of violence in the village. If the man went out and go and look, search for the work, for the job to get it, when he came back at evening, he find you have nothing to cook, he can jump up and fight you. That what were you been doing since morning up to today, up to night? Why? Where is the food? Where is the water?
Agal had her right arm amputated when she was caught in crossfire during the civil war, aged just 8.
Then maybe the child fall after you 6. Maybe you try, you bring the child here, and you will not ask the money for the man to take the child to the facility or to any clinic to buy the drug. So that one will make you to fight with the husband also if you have that money for the treatment.
After years of beatings, a girl's husband eventually abandoned the family.
Actually, I survived for myself. The husband went to Khartoum. Up to today, he is not around.
What's up, Albin? Betan we coach.
As well as providing counselling, concerned social workers host daily awareness-raising sessions, educating the community about gender-based violence and how to put it to an end.
We all know that GBV is in so many forms. We have the physical violence, sexual violence, emotional assault. Yeah, even the other forms are like forced marriage, which is in our community here. The forced marriage is the very, very common when you find like girls of the age 18, 15 are getting married. So we want to stop that. And for us to stop...
Rebecca Atongdeng's audience can be as many as 80. The men, women and children listen intently under the shade of a large mahogany tree.
We understand that GBV is against our cultural norms. To all some of the cultures, forced marriage is like normal, but it's not normal. It's really not normal. To some of our cultures here, being married at a young age is normal, but in reality it is not normal, because if you get married at an early age, there are disadvantages. But for us, we can prevent that by saying no to forced marriage. If I said it today, I tell you tomorrow, you go do it at home, we are able to change. So most
it's a positive sign, not just for those fleeing the conflict, but for the local South Sudanese as well, as they try to establish gender equality in this, the world's youngest nation.
We have fathers here, we have mothers here, we have sisters here. Once you understand what we are teaching you people on a daily basis, you go apply it at home, it's able to change something. For us to change GBV, it needs all of us to come together and work on it. I cannot change GBV, you cannot change GBV, but all of us can change it if we come together and work on this. Of course, I welcome the ideas. And
yes, actually, it is not easy to do a GBV project, because community look GBV is like community look GBV like is fighting with culture. The change is coming, but it is not actually as an organization we are not going to eliminate completely, but we are make a GBV mitigation. We are now reducing it, but we cannot eliminate completely because it is a process. Yes.
Still, I can't help but be troubled by the stories I've heard here. and the countless more yet untold. As we pack up the Jeep to leave, I ask Amelia how she copes working in this area day after day.
Yeah, it is a difficult area to work in as a humanitarian worker and also as a person at an individual level. You know, sometimes the stories, they get to you. There was a story one time of a lady who was on her way from Sudan who was abducted by the soldiers, and they stayed with her for some months. And when she was finally released, you know, she was pregnant, and it was a traumatizing experience for her. And when she was released, she was in her third trimester. So we could not terminate the pregnancy, and she gave birth to the baby. So one, you feel for the lady, two, you feel for the child. You know, the child is born out not out of love, and I'm not sure if the lady will be able to love that child as a mother should be, because, you know, you look at the child as a reminder of what happened to you. But we managed to counsel her to continue. Even up to now, we continue to talk to her. She's accepting it, but it was a hard experience for her, and it was one of those touching experiences for me as well. You know, because sometimes you think, if it was me, how was I going to handle it? Well, sometimes it really hits hard. And if you don't also get support, it can get down, it can get you down so much that we not only offer psychosocial support to the returnees and the refugees, but also to ourselves. But we have been managing, and we will continue to manage to assist those who are in need of our assistance.
Before we leave the refugees to finish today's awareness-raising session, an older woman drops the reed mat she's been weaving. She stands up and gestures toward my microphone. Slightly confused, I hand it to her.
She said that first she went to give a word of appreciation to all of you that have took your time to come here. They are really happy that you people are able to value them and know that this place, Macharakud, exists, and you people took your time to come here, had a session with them. They are very, very happy as the community.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Tell her thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
You're listening to Can You Hear Me? Dispatches from the World's Forgotten War on Documentary and Drama on Newstalk.
What sort of music is this?
It's church music.
Oh, really?
Choir music.
Very different to our church music.
My last stop here in South Sudan is Wedweil Refugee Camp, where more than 20,000 Sudanese refugees have found temporary shelter. There's a line wrapping around the World Food Programme tent distributing rations. There's a makeshift market with stalls selling fabric and tea. On a football pitch nearby, a refugee team will soon face off against their local rivals. And deeper into the camp, small but sturdy houses are gradually replacing UNHCR tents. But the camp here at Wedweil may soon fall to chaos as refugee numbers are set to explode.
My name is Nicodemus Mwetpiaps. I work for Commission for Refugees Affairs as Assistant Commissioner.
We are expecting 300,000. So far, we have about 55,000 refugees that we need to relocate from Garam refugee camp at Juba, central Equatoria. We are also relocating the refugees from Ren. We are seeing the potential of having 300,000 refugees.
For those here already at Wedweil, life is slowly beginning anew. Mutasim is one of the refugees who managed to create a business here.
His mechanic shop is busy, fixing the motorbikes favoured by most who have vehicles in the camp and the area.
He has come from Sudan, especially in the area called Darfur. He was a mechanic, even he worked with the NGO school, World Food Program, as a mechanic. But when these things erupt out, then he managed to come here. He's saying that the business he likes so much, it is a mechanic work. Anything related to the machine, they do repair it. And one is he's doing it, he feel happy because he's the one that harness more to the family. And he prefer to do it more in case he got any assistance from any well-wishers.
For all Matusam's hard work and dedication, he takes in about 15 South Sudanese pounds a day. The equivalent in euros is just 10 cents.
He said the money is not catering the whole family. It's very small, but he just push. It's kind of pushing life, and the money is not enough for the family.
How many people is he supporting?
He's responsible for 7 people.
A short walk away, Medina is tailoring a dress.
I was working in a health sector in Sudan, yes, but when I came here, it is a new work for me. The most things are like people sewing their clothes and some being like bigger, they cut it down also to make it the size they wear. And sometimes it comes like they come like 2 or 3 a day. Okay, she has her own family, and she also support her mother, and also she support with her uncle. The uncle is sick with asthma at home. There no one is supporting in the house except me. I'm working this one, and so I support with the amount that I get from this business. The money I earn is very little, and it's not enough because the needing is too much.
Surrounding the mechanics and the tailor shop is scorched earth and the ruins of other market stalls. The remnants, I'm told, of a recent attack on the refugees by local youths. It's the first sign of resistance to the refugees I've seen since I got here. Mirham, our translator, had a fruit and veg shop here. It was burned to the ground.
The market was really very, very live and was really very wonderful and good, and people used to get some money. Because some they had experience of making business since they were in Sudan, and they started to make business here, and it was running very well, and they were really very happy. There were clubs and there were nightclubs, and people used to go and like have a cool drinking water, and it was really very nice. And what happened is that there was a looting of the market in the morning, and after they loot the market, all the things, they burn it down, and everything now got lost. And it was not only the market. We were staying outside the residential areas. People came and attacked the people inside, the refugees, in their houses. So that was the most frightening. And so all of the residential areas, they flew to inside the center here. Mm.
Do you plan to stay here in Wedwil? What is your...
No, not at all. I'm not planning to stay here at all. I'm planning to see another safer area where I can take my family, so where they can feel okay and like that.
There are major ethnic, cultural and religious differences between the two nations. Sudan is Arab and Muslim, while South Sudan is Black African and Christian. It's also not long since Sudan and South Sudan were at war, as the South Sudanese fought to establish their independence. And cases like the recent attack here at Wedwil show some tension and resentments linger. Still, for the most part, the South Sudanese have been incredibly welcoming to the refugees, particularly considering they have so little to share. South Sudan has also been badly impacted economically by the conflict up north. It has oil, but it's pumped through Sudan, and the war has halted that completely. Civil servants, teachers and nurses haven't been paid in a year. It's hard to fathom how a country with such a fragile economy and health system could possibly absorb the refugees crossing its border. 24% of the refugee and returnee children are malnourished. The WHO considers anything above 15% to be crisis level. But South Sudan is teetering itself on the edge of famine, and local children show up to the stabilisation centres here for the severely malnourished, just as regularly as refugees.
So this is stabilization. We have 6 beds, and for now we have 3 patients.
Isaac Garang is the day nurse at the stabilization center at Gok Makar. He's in the middle of a 12-hour shift, which he does 7 days a week.
Yes, I always be, like now, I'm working for the whole day. And William will come later to work for the whole night. Then tomorrow again, I will come to work day. So I just rest, we just rest for some minutes, some hours, I mean. I'm tired, but we are helping our community. Yes, it's very important here.
Rebecca's 9-month-old daughter, Sarah, is receiving a mid-upper arm circumference test for malnutrition.
They were twins. Then one passed away. She gave birth at the home, not in the facility. So when the children were not okay, she took them to the Majankar PACC. So the one twin was having medical complication. The complications were serious. And the PACC in charge was trying to refer the child to a Will hospital, the big hospital. So on the way to a Will hospital, the child passed away. So after the one passed away, so this child started having medical complications. She's saying that the child is having constant fever, and the child doesn't grow. And the child is having stomach problem. And the child is having loss of appetite.
Rebecca's daughter looks more like 4 or 5 months than 9. But she has more hungry children than just this at home. And when she leaves here with Sarah's therapeutic food rations, it will be hard not to share the plumpy nut among the family. It's an incredibly difficult decision. Nourish one child fully, or many children, but much less. Mary, here with her 6-month-old son, feels the strain before even leaving.
She's saying that those children, she left at home. Nobody is taking care of them. Even one of them came here and said that, Mama, when are you coming to us at home? Because the father is not available at home. She's saying that since I was at home, I was the one going to the market to look for food for them. But now nobody is giving them food.
War wreaks devastation in many ways, physically, emotionally, mentally. A book, comforting her 3.5-year-old stepson, is affected by all three.
So they don't have enough food to eat. Of course, there is no father. I'm their father, I'm their mother. She said that they were in Sudan. Then the husband told them that you go to South Sudan and will remain here. The husband died in Sudan while they are here. So now she is with her stepchildren. The mother of these children, she's having mental disorder. She's not okay mentally. That's why she's taking care of the children and the mother also. She's saying that these are my children now because I did not give birth since I got married. So I see them like my own children. She's the one taking responsibility now.
However bad things are now, they're about to get a whole lot worse. The imminent USAID cuts have been hovering like a blackened rain cloud over everywhere I've been. The exhausted staff working with no days off, the impending cholera outbreak and dirty water, the traumatised exiles with barely enough food to keep their stomachs quiet. And yet, try as I might, no official, NGO, UN or otherwise, will properly address just what that impact might be and how soon it's to be felt. Finally, by a stroke of luck, I'm sat next to Andy Harrington on my first of 4 flights home. He's the executive director of the Canadian Food Grain Banks, an organisation that funds charities like Trokera. And while the other passengers disembark, he agrees to go on the record.
Okay, great. So why are you in South Sudan this week, Andy?
We have 2 objectives. First of all, we're checking out some of our programmes that we have here. We fund for our members. So we've been looking at some of the food assistance programming we're doing up in Awil. And secondly, we're trying to assess the damage that's been done by the cuts to USAID, which have really profoundly impacted the global infrastructure for development.
And what have you seen? What has been your reflections after seeing what you've seen?
Well, it's quite devastating, actually. We've been looking at childhood malnutrition programs, at health clinics, food assistance programs that are just being stopped. So, for example, I was in Awil East refugee camp yesterday, and we saw bags of USAID grain that was being distributed. We asked if there was any more. They said, no, this is the last load. That's a good proportion of the food that's been distributed in that camp disappeared. We then went to meet with a UNHCR childhood malnutrition program. They told us that program would be closing, and I was literally mobbed by women outside saying, you've got to keep this open, our children will die. We're already hearing stories of children dying from malnutrition, even in the early days.
Mm. And what's the feeling of the staff that are working there?
Absolute devastation. I met with one of the leaders at the childhood malnutrition center in the camp, and he was really distraught, asking us if we could step into the gap, asking us if we could help. Desperately concerned at some of the women. He was telling me that, as we know, malnutrition starts in the womb. So they were trying to trying to tell people in the villages that were coming in, especially women who were about to have babies, we have no help for you here. So he was virtually in tears. Our concern really is that 50% of the global aid infrastructure has disappeared. There was absolutely no notice this was going to happen. So there's no potential to set up alternative systems, no potential to really triage. We're very much at the stage of a car crash where someone has lost an arm, a leg, had an eye ripped out, maybe a kidney, and we're trying to figure out how can we build a new system in the midst of that. Right now, we've just got to try and save what we can. Our organization funds Trocare, an Irish organization. We have nutrition programs with them in Somalia and Sudan, food assistance programs. And I know that Trocare is very concerned as they think about how the infrastructure all comes together.
What do you see the outcome of these cuts being in the short and long term?
In the short term, disaster. We're going to see many more deaths, tens of thousands of deaths probably, especially amongst women and children. In the long term, there may be some implications in terms of the way the global infrastructure works. What you've got to remember is that whilst, you know, an organization like Canadian Food Grains Bank can carry on its programming because our funding comes from the government of Canada and Canadians, not from the US, it plugs into an infrastructure that everybody contributes to. So, for example, we've just flown on a UN flight. That's funded by the USAID. It's essential to be able to get food personnel into critical emergency areas. That's just one example. We're hearing of people who work on gender-based violence programs. They're often headquarters staff that are funded from four or five different pots. We fund that. So we're now looking to say, well, how can we step in the gaps that 50% of the funding has disappeared? That's just one example. Another example would be that we do food assistance programming, but we do it alongside people who are doing WASH, water sanitation program, health programs and others. If those programs are disappearing, we can still do our food assistance, but the basic necessities of life that others are really needing will be taken away in the midst of that. So the implications are not good. We will find ways forward. It's really, really important that governments like Ireland, the Irish government, the Canadian government and others maintain humane and compassionate aid, which is an investment in the future, not just for people, but for all of us. So we will find ways forward, but right now it's actually very difficult to imagine. Mm.
Touching down at Dublin Airport, swapping searing heat for falling rain, I'm overwhelmed by what I've seen of the war in Sudan, how it's scattered, slaughtered and devastated its people. And I'm anxious about Trump's looming aid cuts and what more anguish they'll cause the vulnerable community I've met. Still, shattered and heartbroken as they are, there is a regal dignity to these forgotten people, who ask nothing of me but that I share their stories. Today, on this station at least, you have listened, and they have been heard.
Can You Hear Me? Dispatches from the World's Forgotten War was produced and reported by Sarah Madden. If you've been affected by what was discussed in this programme, you can contact the Samaritans on free phone 116 123. Paeta House can be reached on 1800 247 247 and Women's Aid is available on their 24/7 helpline 1800 341 900. You can donate to Concern's Sudan Crisis Appeal at concern.net. For more, see newstalk.com.